You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Edmund White, the author most recently of Genet, the monumental biography of Jean Genet published by Knopf, also the editor of the selected writings of Jean Genet recently brought out by the Echo Press, and of course novelist of, among other things, The Beautiful Room is Empty, Nocturnes for the King of Naples, Caracol, Forgetting Elena, and A Boy's Own Story. To start off, why Genet?
Well, my favorite editor, Bill Whitehead, asked me if I knew anyone who could write a biography of Jean Genet back in 1986, right after Genet had died. And I sort of timidly said, me. And Bill died right afterwards, and I dedicated the book to him. But in fact, I think Genet was a writer I had always admired since I'd first read him in the 60s in English. I think as a gay writer myself, I admired Genet very much because he was the only one who was really sort of in your face about being gay, and who didn't present homosexuality as a disease but as a crime, who showed the ghetto, who included a character in his books named Jean Genet, and who wrote in this sumptuous style.
You know, in your own work, in Nocturnes, for instance, that Doc Cum Ruined Cathedral is very much a Genet kind of trope. And so, too, at the end of A Boy's Own Story, the young man, having seduced his teacher, turns him into the school's headmaster, which seems a kind of mini-Genet betrayal. Had he been a big influence on your work?
Yeah, although I think it's interesting how influences actually get communicated. I was in love with a guy who was much older than me, who was a jazz musician, who loved Genet. And he tried to live his life as though he were a Genet character. And I think somehow that's the way that literary influence gets communicated more often than just reading a book and trying to write in that style.
I wondered at first when I heard you were doing the biography of Genet, I kind of looked forward to it with great anticipation and thought that it would be the sort of book like Nabokov on Gogol or Beckett on Proust. What made you want to write a lengthy biography rather than a subjective work of aesthetic criticism?
Once I got into it all, I realized that I had sort of a sacred responsibility to write a real biography because I was interviewing all these people who were soon going to die. I mean, in other words, Genet was pretty old when he died, and his whole crowd was old, and most of them have died, or many of them have died since I've interviewed them. So I really realized that if I didn't get all this down, it was all going to vanish. And I don't know, I think if you actually write fiction, you don't want to write another. I mean, at least in my case, when I turn to a new form, it's because I want to do something entirely different in it. I think Genet was like that too. I mean, when he made a movie, he made a silent movie, which is rather unusual for a writer. I mean, I think he wanted to make something entirely visual because it was a relief from his other work. And I think in my case, I didn't want to do a literary study or a very subjective response of my own. And I'm proud that in the book I never used the word I once in 700 and something pages. I mean, I wanted to actually to do an old-fashioned biography that begins at the beginning and goes to the end and tells the whole life story. And, of course, among all those things are his books, and I did want to give my opinions about his writing. But I love the Nabokov book on Gogol. I think that's sensational. But it isn't a biography.
No, of course not. And yet it's funny. As I was reading this, I noticed early on, for instance, in a footnote, there's Derrida's note that Genet's Jean Genet, a name full of soft, spongy consonants, sort of spineless, without bones. indicating, Derrida says, with his sort of superstitiousness about naming, an initial, a predictive passivity. Some pages on, Genet's astonishing statement that he doesn't think, I think it's Miracle of the Rose, is a novel because no character makes a decision. The book is crossed by a kind of heat lightning of startling statement, of which I know you're capable, having read your essay, say, on Schuyler, on William Spackman, on Coleman Dowell. It seemed to be an exercise in restraint.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, I didn't want to put myself in the foreground or my opinions. I mean, after all, this book is being read by lots of people who've never even heard of me, and especially in France. I notice that you have all my books in front of you, and so I assume you've read them, but you'd be surprised how few people have. And I mean, I mean, in other words, I'm perfectly aware that I'm a minor writer and Genet's a great writer, and I was writing the biography of a great writer and had a responsibility to do the right job.
I had picked up your first book, Forgetting Elena, for two different reasons. One was a comment about it by Nabokov, which, of course, at that time was like being commended by God. I mean,
right.
he didn't talk very frequently about young writers. And the second was that Donald Barthelme had given me The Galley, having been passed it by John Ashbery. And I thought, well, you know, what a lineage. And so I did wonder about that. It seemed to me as if your career began as a kind of art novelist. Did you change directions?
I don't think so. I mean, I feel that the real avant-gardism of today is an avant-gardism of content, and that writing about the gay experience is a way of being new. I mean, in other words, there are a lot of people writing gay novels now, but I still feel that there's a lot to be said, and I'm rather shocked by how quickly gay novels have fallen into formulas and just seem to be doing, you know, the same thing over and over again and repeating each other and have kind of settled for a slightly schlocky level, I think, of literacy. But it does seem to me that if you really excavate that site in a serious way, there's an awful lot to be said. I mean, Genet actually is an example of the same thing, I think. I mean, Genet really was new in writing about all these things. He was the first person to do it. And I think that if the writing has so much energy, it's an energy that comes partly from unleashing new subject matter. I mean, we don't really have a formalist aesthetics that allows us to talk about the importance of subject matter. We don't really know how to talk about it. But the truth is that the subject matter is important to painters and even to composers, certainly to novels.
It seems to me that there in France with Gide, Cocteau, and Genet, there is that initial moment where, as subsequently with black literature and women's literature, gay literature was world literature. Or at least it seems so now, looking back on it.
Oh, it was then, too. I mean, certainly, I mean, even today, the French get very nervous if you start talking about black literature or gay literature or Jewish literature, and they think it's a loss of human freedom to categorize books in that way. They also think it's against the whole purpose of literature, which is to speak across a chasm to other people.
I'm speaking to Edmund White on the occasion of his biography of Jean Genet, called Genet, published by Alfred Knopf. I'm curious what you think has happened to Gide. Recently, I guess under the influence of my friend Dennis Cooper, I reread The Counterfeiters and discovered chapter after chapter of truly glorious stuff. A nighttime wrestle with an angel who takes the boy hero on a tour of Paris. And yet it seems, even in your book as well, as if Gide is a kind of sociological disease to be avoided. I wonder how that came to be.
I haven't actually reread The Counterfeiters. It's funny you mention it because I bought it not long ago, and I would like to reread it. And it always seemed to me a very dense book and hard to get into. I mean, it's somehow not a very inviting
book. But you're talking about Genet.
Well, that's true, too, isn't it? Genet I always find instantly seductive. I know that people complain that it's hard to turn the page, and read on with him, that you admire every sentence, but you're never invited to turn the page. But that's not my case. I mean, I really find him a great page turner. But it must be because his particular sensibility really overlaps what turns me on. I mean, I really find it so beautiful and transformative. I mean, it seems to me that more than any other writer, he sort of fulfills Baudelaire's idea of writing about dirt and making it into gold. And, of course, that was Nietzsche's program, and Nietzsche was his favorite philosopher, and that's really what he wanted to do. To me, there's something very essentially poetic about that. I mean, I think what a metaphor does is to establish a rapport between two things that are as far apart as possible. If they're really close, if you say her tears were like a waterfall, you're comparing water and water, and it's rather boring. But if you compare, if you say the gangrene went around his leg the way ivy goes around a marble statue, you've compared things across such a void of difference that you've established your own magical powers as a writer. And to me, that Genet is the supreme magician. Gide is a very different kind of writer. He's the writer of what's called le style blanc, you know, the white style, a style that to me seems slightly, not in the counterfeiter so much, but in things like the Symphonie Pastorale and in Straight as the Gate and The Immoralist. It's this kind of very pure, neutral French style, which is for a long time was considered the ideal, but that now seems to me slightly colorless in the way I think that American minimalism will seem slightly colorless in 20 years.
Well, I think with minimalism, the point is its colorlessness. With Gide, I mean, that's not really steel zero, you know. I think if you do reread The Counterfeiters, you may not exactly be surprised, but its anticipation of Genet is extreme. It opens with a boy stealing books,
being observed
by an older man, and the levels of plot manipulation are also montage strains, scenes in a school, scenes in the literary world, and scenes in a kind of supernatural world dominated by angels of a sort who consort with the boys. It seemed to me I'd been so fed Gide's Protestantism, his evasions, and a kind of calculated restraint, that I was shocked to find The Counterfeiters what it was.
Yes, well, I look forward to rereading it. You make it sound inviting.
Can you describe the effect of Genet on the literary scene? It sounds extremely staggered, you know, since the book was published in two private editions and people were talking more about Genet first. Was there ever a point that Paris was able to see him as a stylist?
Well, I remember one time Milan Kundera said to me that the atmosphere in which a book first emerges determines its reception for at least the next 30 years. And I think that Genet always would ask his friends, "Do you think I'm just a pornographer?" And he would complain that people read his work only because they were prurient. And it's been more than 30 years. Maybe it's so powerful was the charge of his books when they were first published. It's been a long time coming for people to look at Genet as a great novelist and stylist, but they do now. I mean, mind you, from the very beginning, the writers knew that he was. I mean, whether it was Girondeau, whether it was Cocteau, whether it was Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir says when she read Our Lady of the Flowers, just a chapter of it that was in a magazine along with Sartre's No Exit, that immediately she and Sartre said, this is the only good novel being written now, and this is the hope of the novel. And Sartre, when he came to America in 1945 on his first trip, had a luncheon with the editors of the Partisan Review, and they said, tell us about Camus. And he said, oh, well, Camus's okay, but there's only really one genius living in France today, and that's Jean Genet. So I think, you know, it's no accident that this is a man who's attracted the attention of both Sartre and Derrida, not to mention Foucault, that Boulez wanted to collaborate with him, that Pompidou courted him. I mean, people recognized, at least French people, very early on, that this was no prison primitive, or a kind of wacky gay boy. I mean, this was a great artist and one of the great writers of the century. But I think the public still has a trouble with him. And my own theory is that most readers are women and middle-class women. I mean, I know many women who are writing their theses on Genet and stuff like that, but I do think it takes a certain amount of stretching for middle-class women to deal with this stuff, which is really inassimilable. And it's fascinating that in France, everybody, the cliché now in France is that Genet and Céline are the two greatest writers after Proust, but Genet's still not taught in the schools, nor will he be. He'll never be taught. He's a scandal, and he'll always be a scandal.
Lionel Abel, who was at that famous Partisan Review lunch and who knew Genet a bit, had said to me that Genet truly felt that Sartre had killed him in the writing, of course,
right.
Saint Genet. I wonder what you feel would have been Genet's response, given that he hated being revealed, to a biography, and would you have written it if he were still alive?
I don't actually like the idea of writing about people who are still alive. There are two people writing my biography now, and I find that very creepy and strange and, of course, very invasive, because you do want to use that material yourself and you want to be the person who has the proprietorship over that, over your own life. I think it was Nabokov who called biography psychoplagiarism. In a way, James Merrill, the poet, uses the Ouija board, and he communicated with Genet and recently and asked him what he thought of my book. And Genet was pursuing some sailor and wanted to talk mainly about that, but he did say that he thought it was okay.
It's an interesting book to me because, you know, in certain ways, it's very discreet. You choose, as a biographer, not to situate yourself on any of the moral demarcations that make Genet still controversial. And unfortunately, to our great despair, we live in a world in which his style is not controversial. And, you know, this is, you know, a nightmare. But at the same time, you begin by tracking down what you say is a doting family is the word that they've been using. Is this an opening by rape? I mean, is this the way in which this biography announces an initial stance towards Genet that then is perhaps gentled as the book goes along?
Well, I didn't have a strategy in mind. I only wanted to tell the truth. And the truth is that I interviewed 13 people in the village who knew Genet and who knew his foster parents, and they all attested to the fact that he was adored by his foster mother, which is quite different from the legend of Genet's childhood. But I never try to unmask Genet, and I hope I'm never guilty of the vulgarity of suggesting that his novels are lies and therefore not good or important. I think what I tried to do is, for instance, with the childhood, to say that it's almost as bad to have a very frail purchase on paradise as to be really beat with a bullwhip every day. I mean, in other words, Genet could see other children of public welfare living around him who really were starved by their foster parents, who were tied to the chair, to the leg of a table, who weren't fed till noon after they'd already worked for 6 hours in the field, who were tortured by alcoholic foster fathers, and so on. And it's interesting that when he wrote about his own childhood in Our Lady of the Flowers, he assigned to the character who was based on himself the name Louis Coulefoy, which is the real name of a boy who was tortured in that way by his foster parents. But Genet was raised by a woman who kept a tobacco and sweets shop right next to the school, who did adore him, who was very nice to him, who wouldn't hear any stories, wouldn't accept the truth of any stories about him as being a thief. And he was well-fed. He never had to work in the fields. He was allowed to go to school every day. He was the priest's favorite acolyte. He was the best student in the whole region. And it's a very different picture from the one that we've received. But I still feel that if a boy has to wear a uniform of the public welfare, and the the real children of the village, the Feast de Famille, wear ordinary clothes. And the kids from public welfare were called culs de Paris, which means that they were seen as asses from Paris. That is, they were associated in everyone's mind as children of prostitutes. And, I mean, there really were stigmas. And perhaps to the degree that one was almost integrated in the family and had this sort of, as I say, frail purchase on paradise, that makes it all the more painful. When you know from the very beginning that at age 12 it's all going to come to an end, that at that point public welfare will no longer pay a salary to your foster parents, and at that point you have to become a field hand, or if you're a girl, a domestic servant, or if you're very brilliant, as was Janae's case, you're sent off to a trade school.
I wondered, though, about the subjectivity of that. I mean, certainly, I think in many writers' cases who would announce that they had had horrible childhoods, that these were not objectively horrible childhoods, and that the monstrousness of a parent, however fantasized, is still monstrousness. I mean, it's very rare that children don't get petted for their good grades, and yet that can still be an atrocious relationship. Also, it seems to me that at that point, Janae seems like someone who is nettled by everything and was his life long, by people who coughed when he'd read to them. So it would not take very much for a parent to be a nightmare.
Well, I wonder, though. I mean, I have the feeling that he was actually very fond of his foster mother. His foster father seems to have been almost invisible and very passive. But his foster mother had a real son named George, who was considerably older than Janae, who went off to fight in the war and came back filled with shrapnel, became an alcoholic. About that time, Janae's foster mother died, and George began to beat Janae all the time. And I think what was released was this genie from the bottle of this real sibling rivalry that had been there all the time, and Janae was really defenseless in protecting himself against that. I mean, it's interesting that Janae, in Miracle of the Rose, describes a scene in which a boy is at a reform school and the other boys pick on him and they start spitting on him. And the child who's being attacked decides to smile. And Janae describes this smile as this kind of armor, just as he describes in Our Lady of the Flowers how he would nurse tears and allow them to come right up to his eyes and then he would drive them back down. And he would do this again and again as a way of sort of being in touch with his rage, frustration, humiliation, but mastering it. And I think this is the real rhythm of Janae's psyche. Certainly he was somebody who would have preferred any emotion on the part of the reader except pity.
I'm talking to Edmund White, the author of the biography Janae, of Jean Janae, that's just been published by Alfred A. Knopf. I've heard that there are differences between the British edition of this book and the American. What are they?
Oh, they're infinitesimal. They're just little tiny corrections of fact that, I mean, since the American edition came out later, I had a chance to correct a few things. The American editor at one point wanted to scrap the whole book if I didn't make certain changes, and I refused to make them. What I think there was a real culture conflict because I really believe in sociology more than psychology. Americans who are romantics believe in individualism and want to only see the heroic individual stripped free of the entire surround. And I found that ludicrous and refused to bow under to that kind of pressure. So we had a real standoff, and finally they backed down. And now the book's been very well received in America, so I'm pleased. But I feel like I sort of won that round.
Are you not a romantic?
Yes, in the sense that I love a kind of romantic tone in my writing. I believe in love, that sense of romantic, but not in the sense that I believe that people are untouched by their environment. I mean, I really think that there's so few things you can really say about another person and how they came to be the way they are. And it all seems to me pure speculation. But among those speculations, the most dubious of all seems to me psychoanalysis. And the most sure-footed seems to me to be sociology. In other words, I would prefer rather than speculating about Genet's relationship with his foster mother, which I don't speculate about, I present all the facts so that somebody else could do that speculation if they want to. Or, for instance, I never use the kind of cliché, because Genet was abandoned by his real mother at age 7 months, he was never able to become intimate with anybody ever after. I hate that kind of Oprah Winfrey sort of logic, and I don't use it anyplace in the book. But if I eschew that, it does seem to me very interesting to say that Genet's house, where he grew up, was dead center between the school and the church, and that those were the two warring institutions of the Third Republic, and that the church really represented all the old feudal values which Genet was highly attracted to. And it's no accident that all the metaphors in his novels are drawn from either the world of the aristocracy or the world of the church. But on the other hand, if he had any opportunities at all and was allowed to rise in the world at all, it was due to the school, which was the secular bastion of progressive Third Republic values, which basically Genet rejected. And he was a severe critic of that kind of democratic, progressive, scientific, positivist spirit. He loathed it, and indeed it was pretty despicable. I think that's interesting to talk about that and to see Genet as somebody positioned between those two institutions.
What you say is terrifically interesting to me, because as I was reading the Genet prose, and I was just rereading before we started the summary of his fiction at the final pages of part one of your biography, I thought to myself that simultaneous status as subject and object, the examination of a thing by displaying its lining, the presence of the double in the mirror, that if anything were the double of the structural tenets of Genet's prose, it would be Lacanian psychoanalysis. That somehow or other, without myself being particularly interested in psychoanalysis and inheriting to some extent Nabokov's disdain for it, it struck me as being terrifically interesting that the syntax of these sentences seemed laid bare to reflect this doubling and redoubling alienation from and love to self that Lacan writes about.
I think what I wanted to do in my book was really to provide the material for the kind of speculation that you might have or that other people have already had. For instance, Philippe Solaire's read my book and then sat down and wrote the introduction to Biblos, and he credits me. He's very nice about it. What I felt that I was able to do with my research, which I'm most proud of and which I think is considerable, was to lay in front of people all the materials that they could use for making this kind of speculation that you're doing or that Solaire's did.
I'm speaking to Edmund White, the author of The Fine Biography of Jean Genet, recently published by Alfred Knopf. And thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Scott Fritz. Join us once again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Book time.